ABC Radio Australia.
For centuries, mystery surrounded the origins of the giant head statues of Easter Island, or Rapa Nui as it's known to locals. An even bigger question was how these massive stone statues, the largest weighing over 120 tonnes and standing 26 metres in height, were able to be moved without modern technology. Well, their mystery appears to have been solved thanks to new research study on the Mo'ai statues. So for more on this mystery, we're joined by Professor Carl Lipa from New York's Binghamton University. That I say, good morning, Professor, and welcome to Pacific Beat.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Good morning to you.
Absolutely. Appreciate your time this morning, Professor. Let's get straight into it. I mean, what did your study find about how the Mo'ai were even moved around?
Well, we did a number of things. We built a 3D model of the quarry that they're carved from, using photogrammetry, drones and cameras to generate a really high detailed model of the quarry. And that provided incredible detail about the different steps that went into constructing and transporting these Mo'ai, figuring out the different techniques that were being used, the different sort of organization that went into involved. And it's really sort of a remarkable story about a small group of people able to move these gigantic figures.
Wow. I'd love to know, why did the people of Rapa Nui themselves build these massive stone statues?
That's a great question. You know, and unfortunately, early Europeans that got there never bothered to ask. You know, they saw these things and were sort of like floored by them, but they didn't ask. What we do know, though, is that they represent ancestors. This is a very common theme across Polynesia, where you honor your ancestors by building large stone uprights or wooden uprights that sort of honor those ancestors. And the ancestors there were stood up on platforms to look over the community to give them guidance for the future. Something that was really needed on this remote and isolated island that, you know, the communities really needed that sort of guidance by their ancestors to survive.
Professor, can you maybe explain to us how they were able to do it to do this sort of building?
Sure. It's a multi-step process. They first carve them out of this sort of volcanic crater, the outside and inside of this volcanic crater, out of a stone that's made of volcanic ash. They slid them down the slopes of this crater into trenches that they dug out to stand them upright. They needed to stand them upright in order to carve the backs of the statues, because they're usually carved face up, and so they had to finish the back. So they did that standing. Once they got them standing, they then walked them out, and sort of a remarkable way of transportation that doesn't seem likely when you think about it, but when you actually see what's going on, they really use the figure's shape and their form and gravity to help them transport, and rocking them side to side led the statues to move forward in a walking fashion. And they moved them then across the landscape onto these platforms around the island.
And then you often think about technology these days, and then now we hear about this, because, I mean, it's really fascinating stuff, Professor. Besides you sort of talking about them having to, you know, slide down the slopes, rocking it side to side, was there any sort of other tools that early Rapa Nui people used to build these statues?
And what's remarkable is that they really used, you know, they're on an island that's only, you know, it's a pretty small place, 15 kilometers across. It's really, you know, that's it. That's the place that they live. And all the resources they needed to do this had to come from that island. So what's remarkable is they used the things that were available to them. First, the stone tools, the basalt and other kinds of rocks that were on the island. And then the key sort of tool that was important for moving this was the rope. They carved it, they wove rope out of hauhau, a triumfeta, a kind of plant that grows on these islands. And that became the sort of the lines that were able to rock the statue from side to side. Really sort of an ingenious way of moving them that didn't require a lot of technology and really was able to use the resources that they had on the island.
Wow. What's even more interesting is why do you think they stopped making the statues?
That's a good question, because by the time Europeans got there, they really didn't see people moving these statues, and there was a long thought that people sort of used up the resources available to them on the island, and then thus forgot how to make them or were unable to make them. What we actually find archaeologically is that people were making statues and involved with moving these things up until European arrival. When Europeans arrive, people just, you know, were so amazed by different people with different resources that they went to see the Europeans, and the Europeans really never saw people making these statues, but they continue to do so, even though that, you know, when Europeans arrive. What happens though is Europeans bring disease with them, and that causes a real population loss. And so eventually, you know, there just weren't enough people to do that. The society sort of fell apart due to disease. And that was that ended everything.
Wow. Okay, Professor, let's sort of switch now to, you know, your research. I mean, can you outline some of your methods for the study that happened?
Yeah, a number of ways is, you know, people have speculated about Rapa Nui Moai for many, many years, for more than a century, about how they were moved. And people thought, you know, like, let's propose different ways in which they were transported. What we did was really sort of taking archaeology to the extreme, was looking at the details in the archaeological record, looking at the shapes of them, mapping them, you know, measuring their three-dimensional shapes and trying to figure out the physics that had to be involved with moving the statues. We used a lot of different technology for that, you know, including just pedestrian survey, figuring out where all the statues were, but also building really high-resolution 3D models of the statues. We've now moved into using drones and other kinds of technology to really provide really detailed information about the archaeological record. That turns out to be really key. You can speculate all you want on how things could have been, mm-hmm. but the archaeological record really tells you what must have happened.
Also, I understand from just reading up on what you've been doing, but there was something in 2022, right, that there were major wildfires in Rapa Nui. How did this actually maybe set the stage for your research, though?
Yeah, it was an unfortunate event that took place back in 2022. The islanders would often clear some of the land, some of the grasses for new growth for cattle that they were that were maintaining on the island. The sort of fires that they set, unfortunately, you know, went in the wrong direction due to a wind shift and then swept through the quarry. And it was really alarming to the islanders, you know, that this fire would have impact to these statues because they're incredibly important cultural features of their society. That sort of opened the door that people realized on the island, that the community realized that they didn't have a good document of the record of the quarry itself, where all the statues were and their state. So they asked us to use our technology that we were using to sort of map the rest of the island to document the quarry itself. So it opened the door for saying, like, we really needed to use these methods to provide a really detailed map that then the community can use to look at impacts and changes to the Moai themselves.
Mm. Now, I understand, Professor, that there is the volcanic crater, Rano Raraku. I'm just wondering, what was the significance there of the stone quarry at the bottom of that volcano?
The significance of the Moai quarry? I mean, this is 97% of the statues are carved from this particular material. It's a volcanic tuff. It's a compressed ash. And it's sort of the central place that everyone went to gather stone to carve statues. There are other kinds of stone, actually, that were used around the island, basalt and different kinds of scoria and other rock. But really, this particular quarry was the center place where most of the statues were carved. I think there's a lot of dimensions to that. It provides a good stone for carving things. It isn't particularly hard, but it stays together well enough to make these statues. People did it sort of in small groups working simultaneously across this area. So people were able to go to this one spot and see everyone that was carving statues at the same time. So it became a really important cultural place for doing this activity.
One of the things I do want to ask, Professor, because, you know, for our listeners, to those who may not have access to the internet and whatnot, I'm wondering if you could sort of paint us a picture of what these statues actually look like, because I can see it myself and they're really fascinating, very mysterious looking, you know, but I'm just wondering if you could give your description.
Yeah, they're so iconic that, you know, it's they really are striking. They're clearly human figures, sort of tall bowling pin-shaped figures with sort of long, elongated heads with long ears that go along the head. They have a protruding belly that sticks out with their hands wrapped around their belly. Their faces are really the most sort of striking part. They've deep-set eyes, a prominent nose, and sort of, you know, lips that sometimes are sort of smirking and sometimes angry looking to some degree. There's some real personality to their faces that, you know, as they stand there, sort of the stoic faces looking out at you. Really remarkable things to see. And the sizes are just mind-blowing. I mean, the largest ones that were transported are 3 stories tall. If you can imagine sort of a building size figure moving down the landscape, it's really mind-blowing to imagine how these things are moved. And seeing them even in a standing position is just overwhelming. They're just fantastic figures.
Well, with your research then, Professor, now that it's sort of done, like, what is the next step for your study then?
Well, as we understand more of the technology and how the community went about constructing these and transporting them, the question becomes like, well, what led people on this particular island to invest so much energy and so much, you know, of their lives building these statues? And, you know, it certainly wasn't because people, it was a whim. It certainly wasn't because of a crazy idea that somebody had, because they did this over generations, 500 years of carving these gigantic statues and moving them. So it was something that was really central to the functioning of their society. And this is really the interesting puzzle there. This is an island that's thousands of kilometers from any other island, that's out in the middle of the Pacific, yet And it's very small with very limited resources, yet this is the place you find these gigantic figures. So the next real question, I think the real mystery, which I think is an important question to answer, is why did they do this? Because I think it was something that was very important that led them, that made them survive on this island. It was part of the key to their resilience in a place that was really sort of a remarkable place to live at all.
Yeah, I mean, I love these types of conversations, Professor. It obviously gives us an insight into the history, you know, of our Pacific nations and really what they did. I'm wondering, how can we make that so real to us in this sort of generation now, like for the next generation? Are these sort of statues and things like this, do you think we could replicate it? Do you think these things could be made again?
Yeah, I mean, I think the key to understanding the statue is that it was a group of people working together to achieve this. They were competing with each other. Different groups were building these things and competing with other groups that were making them. But the key to the success here is that it was a cooperative effort. In modern times, we need these kinds of cooperative efforts. Things that are not necessarily, you know, that are sort of fun to do, that are culturally important, that bring people together so that they know each other and that they can share resources, and they, when things get tough, they know who they can turn to for help. This is the kind of, you know, this is what they needed to survive on this island, something where survival was really tough and they needed each other to be able to survive on this. In the same way, that's the kind of thing that our communities need today, that we need to bring ourselves together where we know our neighbor, we know our neighbor's name, and we know that we can turn to them when things get tough. This is kind of the key to survival in a sort of a risky and crazy environment that we're living in today. So I think there's a lot of fantastic lessons to learn from Rapa Nui that we really can bring to our modern society.
Absolutely. Look, Professor, that's all the time that we have for this morning, but just really appreciate the work that you're doing. And so thank you again for joining us here on Pacific Beat.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you so much.
No worries. That is Professor Carl Lipo from New York's Binghamton University.